Welcome to the Senate Revenue Committee. Today, the Vice Chair is handling the gavel at the request of the Chair because he is having some laryngitis this afternoon. So, in my role as the Vice Chair, I will try to fill in for the Chairman, and we'll begin with opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 391. We have the honor today of having Senator Frank Shields here to present testimony on Senate Bill 391. So in view of his legislative duties elsewhere in the building, I call him first. Senator Shields, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Vice Chair, Senator Hannon. Quite simply, I introduced Senate Bill 391 at the suggestion of a constituent of mine, Judge John Whitmire in Multnomah County. John would have liked to have been here today, but he has a very serious court case that's dragging on in Multnomah County right now, and he just couldn't be here. It's a very simple bill that I think John thought might be a small part of an overall search to find revenue sources wherever appropriate in government. You have a copy of my testimony, right?
Okay. We do, sir. It's been distributed to all members.
Currently, the law permits judges and other judicial officers to perform marriages. They're allowed to charge a small personal fee when the marriages are performed outside of the courthouse or outside of normal working hours, but when they do that in the court, they can't charge anything. When judges perform weddings either in the courthouse in normal business hours or after hours, there's usually some staff time in addition to their own time. Staff answer numerous telephone calls, inquiries from members of the public about weddings, making appointments, receiving the license, filling out the forms, and, you know, all of that stuff. That's tax dollars. Actually, it's being spent at the time. So Senate Bill 391 would do two things. It would establish a new $25 fee for the benefit of the state general fund to be charged when a judge performs a wedding. And number two, it increases the fee charged by a clerk, a county clerk, for the benefit of the county from $15 to $25. Approximately 5,000 weddings are performed each year by active state court judges in Oregon. The $25 fee would generate about $250,000. I know that's small, but, you know, we're looking everywhere. Anyway, I appreciate the committee's consideration of the bill, and I really do urge you to review Judge Whitmire's written testimony. It's three pages. It takes a little bit of time, but it's worth the reading. The rationale is, I think, very cogent. I'd be glad to answer any questions anybody would have.
Colleagues, Judge Whitmire's testimony is attached to your measure summary in the packet that was distributed by staff today. Colleagues, does anyone from the panel have questions on Senator Shields' anti-marriage bill? Senator, I think this is a novel and a unique approach, and you've researched the issue very well, particularly the idea that the ancillary services provided by judicial staff to document the wedding and to record the documents and so forth and so on, in fact, are public services financed by taxpayers. The court does get a $15 fee, probably doesn't cover their costs.
No.
And so this essentially would be a voluntary service performed by judges for the benefit of the general fund. Senator Shields, what becomes of the small nominal personal fee that judges charge? Would they no longer charge that fee, or would that be?
Actually, I've talked to Judge Whitmire about the quote-unquote fee, honorarium, whatever it is, and he considers it, and I didn't get the judge's permission to say this, but he considers it a pain in the neck because they have to document all that, keep very careful records of it. It becomes income. You know, they have to pay taxes and Social Security on it. And he's got to the point where he won't do that at all. He won't accept a fee outside of it. Now, I don't know if he's the only judge in that category. Maybe some judges keep those fees or keep those honoraria. But it's a problem for them. I'd like to point out the converse of that, however, and that is that if you do go into the court and you're doing that wedding, you know, during the day, the judge can't charge a fee. At $25, believe me, for most people getting married, that's a bargain. Well, I mean, it's
does it depend on the product purchase, Senator? I mean, wouldn't you have to take a longer view?
You can be cynical if you wish, sir. I choose not to be cynical. My point, quite simply, is that having done weddings for 30 years, you know, as a pastor, I know the costs involved. The costs involved in, you know, renting a hall or you know, a church or whatever that people do. And this $25 fee to simply go down and have a judge marry is actually an incredible bargain. So I don't see that the public is going to get riled up and call me an anti-marriage senator or anything of the sort. And it will help. I mean, we're looking everywhere we can for money. Why not have this simple little fee that'll cover the cost of and save some money in general fund?
I think that would be excellent. I guess the question for staff is, do we have any fiscal impact on this at all?
Senator, the only estimate we have is what was provided by the judge himself on his estimates of Multnomah County. Fiscal does have a draft in process that we should have this afternoon. We're in public hearing only on this bill today, but by the end of the day, I think we'll have an estimate on what that revenue will be.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Paul. The other issue is let's try and make sure that this won't cost the judge $25.90 to account for this fund going to the general fund, because somebody will have to account for these dollars.
Right.
Appreciate your testimony and further questions. Hearing and seeing none. Thank you, Senator Shields. Mm-hmm. We have one other signed up for testimony, and that would be Carl Myers, who represents Justices of the Peace and Municipal Judges. So we'd call you forward, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Hannon. Carl Myers, for your record, on behalf of the Oregon Justices of the Peace Association, the Oregon Municipal Judges Association. I realized as sitting here that after 20 years of being around this building, this is my first time to testify in front of the Senate Revenue Committee. I hope you'll go easy on me in my first appearance. We agree in theory with the bill. The theory, however, breaks down as it applies to the local courts, the local judges. Under ORS 106120, justices of the peace and municipal judges are judicial officers of the state, but we have different bosses. The JPs are responsible to the county commissioners, and the municipal judges to the local jurisdictions, the municipalities that they represent. We, in most cases, do not even have staff handle those weddings. I'm a municipal judge in Kaiser. I'm paid by the hour, and I do all of the preparation and submission of the documents for a marriage through my law office. The city of Kaiser has nothing to do with that. So the application of this fee, I think, works very well at the state court level, the circuit courts, but it does not work so well at the JPs and municipal court levels because of that fact. If the counties wanted to charge a similar fee, because in most Justice of the Peace courts, the clerk does handle some of those, although most of, as near as I can tell, most of the weddings are performed off hours, but still some of the handling of the paperwork may be done by county staff. But most of the municipal judges are part-time judges such as I, who handle that through their law office or through their home or whatever. And so if a fee were to be charged to cover the costs of handling the paperwork and doing the arrangements to be there and so on and so forth, I'm not sure who that should go to. I do charge for my weddings under the statute allowed for the sort of the honorarium, but that covers my staff's cost and so on, and I run that through my law office's regular income. But I think that while the idea is right, and Judge Whitmire, I think in his letter suggested that maybe it should only, he would suggest an amendment that only applies it to the circuit court judges, and we would tend to agree unless some other arrangements were made to allow the counties to recoup their costs and any city staff time that may go involved with the weddings performed by a municipal judge to be recouped there. But money to the general fund and a fee in every case, I think, is inappropriate as it relates to the local courts. I just wanted to bring that to your attention before you proceeded with this bill. I'd be happy to try to respond to any questions you may have.
Thank you. Just let me call my colleague's attention to this last page of Judge Whitmer's testimony under possible amendments where he deals with those issues. Wouldn't it be in keeping with the principle to allow the municipalities and various jurisdictions that have marrying authority to retain the fee in their own court system rather than return it to the general fund, where ostensibly it would be allocated in some way to all general fund purposes? In other words, would it solve the issue of the various different jurisdictional authorities if the fee that was charged was simply retained for the jurisdiction that provided the service?
Mr. Vice Chair, yes, in the instances where staff time, if in fact that fee is to compensate the government for the staff time that's involved, I think that would be appropriate.
Otherwise it's a tax.
Pardon?
Otherwise it's a tax.
I see no reason in my case, where I do all the handling myself, to impose a fee to cover the staff time at all, because no staff time is used other than what is covered by the honorarium that I charge the people, and whatever it may be, up to the maximum of $100, and I just figure that as part of the fee that I may charge if I charge any fee at all. And a lot of the judges, municipal court judges, are in fact on hourly. They only show up at the court to handle the cases that are in front of them. And they do all the marriage arrangements and any other things they do on their own without the use of municipal staff time. I think it would be appropriate to allow those municipalities that do in fact have full-time judges that do those marriages on their time to charge a fee. But a standard fee, maximum, minimum, I'm not sure how that would work.
Okay.
I just wanted to call to your attention the problems as they filter down to the local courts.
And
the public policy is up to you, obviously.
Well, Mr. Reiner, I appreciate it. So your suggestion is that we limit the scope of the bill to circuit court judges only, if that were the case, or modify it in some way to give the other jurisdictions
the option.
Yeah.
As is appropriate, if in fact this is not a tax but an administrative fee for handling the paperwork, then there ought to be some causal connection between the actual work and to whom the fee goes. That's the point I hope to make.
Questions for Mr. Myers? Hearing and seeing none, then I think if there are other there are other members of the public here present who would like to testify on this bill, let them come forward.
Presiding at Sam Donovan's wedding, they took me held at the county clerk to let me do that.
Good afternoon. My name is Charles Stern. I'm the Yamhill County Clerk and I'm chair of the Oregon Association of County Clerks Legislative Committee.
Welcome.
A couple comments about the bill. One of the policy changes in the bill as drafted is that we're not when a wedding is performed outside the regular working hours, that the fee, the $25 fee, would be charged at that time also. And in the past, it has been kind of, for counties that had a fee of $15, those were, if you had it during working hours, if you had it during non-working hours, then it was such other fee. It wasn't both. In this case, the way it's drafted, it's in addition to the fee required under subsection 3, then you have the personal fee. And I wanted to bring that to your attention, that this is a kind of a double fee in those circumstances. I didn't know if that was the intent of the submitter.
Maybe the double fee was intended to make people think twice.
There are times that those of us that deal with it suggest that they ought to think more than once.
I appreciate your testimony, Mr. Stern. Any questions for Mr. Stern? Hearing and seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Senator Shields, would you come to the podium, please?
I'd like
Senator Shields, District 24. I'd like to respond to that concern just briefly, and that is to say that even if this is done after hours, at least in the circuit courts, you can end up the next day with the judge's assistant or whoever filing papers, doing work. It ends up costing time, and so it's appropriate to have the fee. What I sense being said here is, you know, it becomes a little bit more difficult if the judge is going to get $100 or something in honoraria than to say, oh, there's a $25 fee in addition. And so that might make some people uncomfortable, but I don't think you should overlook it when you think about the fact that you're still using state general fund dollars kind of to subsidize this marriage process, whether it's during the day or in the evening.
Senator, there's been some good suggestions for minor modifications to the concept, but generally, I sense people think that the concept is a good one.
And we don't have any problem with the modifications that have been suggested. This was just an idea to actually kind of get people pay as they go, so to speak.
Thank you, Senator. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 21391. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2197. Because this bill deals with of small woodland taxation, and it is somewhat an arcane area of tax law, I think that we need to have staff orient us as a committee to the purposes of the bill, give us a little history of the small tract forest land taxation issues and what brings the bill to this legislative session, to this committee. And we'll begin there with a little orientation by staff.
Okay.
or we can bring Norm Miller up.
No, that's perfectly fine. I just trying to organize my thoughts for a moment. What we've had...
Much more interested in having you organize my thoughts this afternoon, so proceed.
Basically, in 1999, the legislature began a process, essentially, of exempting timber from taxation and taxing forest land essentially on 100% of its value and eliminating altogether the severance tax. You had in 99 an 80-20 program which was available where the forest land was on the roll at 20% of its specially assessed value or its maximum assessed value, and that the 80% was supposed to be recovered through a severance tax. So conceptually, you were not taxing the timber, you were only taxing the land, but you were using both a property tax and a severance tax to impose that tax on the land. During the 99 legislature, this program was replaced essentially for large owners, for owners of over 5,000 acres of forest land, whereby they would be taxed at 100% and the severance tax, the forest land would be taxed at 100% of its value and the severance tax would go away. The 99 legislature had options for small owners to opt into that program during the phase-in, which was between 99 and 2003. And at the end of that period, they had an option for the small tract or the small owners to opt out of the 100% program. The 2001 legislature essentially, they also called for a study to try and to decide how you should best tax small owners so that most of the tax would occur at the time of harvest. That study did not come to a conclusion. The 2001 legislature essentially said, okay, everyone goes to the 100% program as of 2003. But we're going to give the small people another chance, and so they gave charged Department of Forestry essentially to put together a working group to do, try and get agreement among the players to an optional tax. They came back this session now, in the 2003 session, with a proposal, and basically that was 2197 and is 2197A with a few amendments made on the House side. And so if I can take a few minutes and kind of go through the bill with a bit of a slide presentation here. Basically, you've got 129.
Can we dim the lights just a little, please? Thank you.
You've got about 129 sections in this bill. A lot of it's a big bill, but a lot of it's kind of redundant. And what I'm trying to do here in this first slide is just give you kind of a broad overview for what's going on in the bill. The first thing that it does is to extend the existing 80-20 program for 1 year, and just for 1 year. And then it creates a new optional program called the Small Tract Forest Land Program. The bill then deals with disqualifications in sections 19 to 53, deals with administration of the severance tax in sections 54 through 62. Then in sections 63 through 74, we're dealing with conforming amendments. When you get a new program, there's a lot of existing statutes, and that new program has to be added into those statutes. And the other thing this bill does is to repeal the statutes related to the Western Oregon Small Tract Option Tax. Now, actually, that 2001 legislature did away with that program, but the statutes are still on the books. So, again, when you eliminate a program like that, you've got a lot of conforming amendments that are associated with getting rid of it.
Okay.
And the last section is just some miscellaneous sections for 10 sections, for 11 sections, I guess, which just deal with changes in section references. Extension of the 80-20 program. The current law is essentially that you have a privilege tax on the value of timber, or you had up until January 1 of this year. It is now actually gone. There's no
harvest tax, privilege tax.
Privilege tax, because it is on value.
Right.
And starting July 1 of this year, all forest land would be assessed at 100% of the lesser of its special assessed value or maximum assessed value. What House Bill 2197 does is to extend this program for 1 year. So it imposes privilege taxes during calendar year 2003, this year. So they'll go back to the first of the year. Now, what it does in terms of the valuation, it simplifies a little bit the department's problem and terminate. We'll now have to come up with values for one more year. And it simplifies at least the reporting of that for the harvesters by allowing a much broader use of the stumpage recovery method of valuation, which is dependent upon what the seller actually receives at the mill for the timber. Okay. And that was an amendment that was put in on the House side. And then it allows for forest land to be assessed at 20% of its value for 1 year, the 2003-2004 tax year. Thereafter, the owner has an option. If they qualify, they can be elect to be taxed under the Small Tract Forest Land Program. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they're into the industrial program, the 100% program.
Okay. Question?
Before going to the next slide, was there a fiscal impact, revenue impact done on this part of the proposal?
Not separately on this part of the proposal, no.
Okay, but there is one on the whole.
There would be a positive revenue impact on this part of the program because the severance tax that exists now, which is based on value, is bringing in more money than would be brought in if the property were under 100% evaluation for property tax purposes.
Bringing in more than?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
The new program now, the Small Tract Forest Land Program, which will become optional in 2004. Basically, where you can find these sections in the bill is the property tax part of it is in Section 7, the severance tax, which is now different than the privilege tax. The privilege tax is a percent of the value harvested. The severance tax is a dollar amount per 1,000 board foot of harvest. The application process is in Section 3 of the bill. The requirements to qualify for assessment under this program in Section 4. owner notifications that are required once you're in the program so that the assessor can continue to decide whether you qualify or not. Then the situations under which the assessor must disqualify the property in Section 6. The additional tax that results in Section 31, and then the severance tax by administration and distribution of the money from the severance tax by the Department of Revenue in Sections 10 through 14. Property tax essentially under this program, the formula looks basically like it does for all property. You take whatever your local tax rate is and you multiply it by what your assessed value is under this program. All right, the asterisk means assessed value in the small tract forest land program. We don't know what that is, so you go a little further and it's defined as the lesser of the specially assessed value of land in this program or the maximum assessed value in this program. Well, we still don't know anything. So you go a little further and it says, okay, under this program, the specially assessed value is going to be equal to 20% of the specially assessed value of forest land as determined by the Department of Revenue, which is highest and best use forest land and applies to forest land in the industrial program. So essentially the specially assessed value is going to be 20% of the value that the land would have in the 100% program.
And that would be 5,000 acres or more, and meeting all the other requirements of industrial forest land.
From now on, it will be anybody that isn't in this program.
Or those that have opted to use the program.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Maximum assessed value then has essentially the same definition as it does for any other program. The maximum assessed value in a given year is the larger of 103% of the assessed value of that property in the prior year, or its maximum assessed value in the prior year.
And is that because of the 3% limitation on growth of assessed value?
That's correct.
Thank you.
3% limitation in the growth of maximum assessed value.
Right.
Yeah. Now, because the maximum assessed value really isn't known because you're changing programs, you don't have a history to look back and what it is, determine what it is, this bill specifies for 1 year, 2004-2005, the maximum values that can be put on the roll for those properties. The severance tax is a rate which is applied, again, as I said, for 1,000 board feet of harvested. The program is set up to deal with calendar years. You harvest during a whole calendar year, and then you report the following January how much you harvested that calendar year, and that is subject to a tax rate, which is 3.89 in the west and $3.03 in the east. Because maximum assessed value increases, and in general is going to increase 3% per year, maximum assessed value increases 3% per year, assessed value of property generally will increase. We expect about 3% per year, but it could be less. The harvest rates are indexed because we're trying to replace the property tax with the harvest tax, so the rates are increased. If you had it against value and values were growing, then you might not have to do that, but it's against volume harvested, so the rates are increased. And the way that the rates are increased is to simply take the average harvest value of small tract forest land, again the asterisks, divided by the average value of that same forest land in the prior year. So the increase in the average value of average assessed value of forest land drives the increase in the harvest tax rate. A few details there about how you calculate those things. The application process to qualify a parcel as small tract forest land, the owner has to apply to the assessor if it's all in one county, or to each and every assessor if it's expands beyond the county lines. And the department is supposed to produce forms. So the forms prescribed by the department, and it specifies the minimum content of those forms and the amount of information those forms have to provide. The application must be by April 1st to qualify, again backing up, as of January 1 for the harvest tax and looking forward as of July 1 for the ensuing property tax fiscal year. If the assessor denies the application, they have to give notice, and there's an appeal process specified in the bill. If the property qualifies, then the assessor sends the Department of Revenue notice and a copy of the application, and this is where the department gets some of the information it needs to administer the severance tax and to know which properties are in the small tract forest land program. Requirements to qualify the owner, owner's common ownership, and it defines what common ownership interest is, must be at least 10 acres and may not, and has to be less than 5,000 acres. The applicant must include all forest land in a tax lot. So you can't divide some of it between the 100% program and some between the small tract forest land. If it's in a tax lot, you make a decision, all or nothing. It's also true if it's a contiguous parcel, even if it crosses tax lot. If it's a contiguous parcel, then all of it must be treated the same way, either in the program or out. The Department of Revenue is instructed to develop rules to determine what are the minimum stocking and specie requirements to be in this program, and it will have to meet those requirements as specified by rule. Another thing added in the House, and this should read not disqualified, past tense, within the past 5 years, is the provision which sort of has to do with gaming the system, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, but being in the system to get only 20% property tax assessment for a while, just before a big harvest, opting out of the system to avoid the harvest tax, and then getting back in. So what they're saying, what this provision says, if you opt out of this program, you got to wait 5 years at least before you can get back in. The owner, again, once they're in this program, is required to notify the assessor if there is an acquisition of contiguous forest land. In other words, you've already got a piece qualified of contiguous acres. You buy a new piece of ground which adds to that and is contiguous with that existing forest land. You have to notify the assessor. If your total ownership exceeds the limits, either over 5,000 or less than 10 acres, you have to notify the assessor. Change to a non-forest land use, and the assessor, any of these notifications, the assessor copies to the Department of Revenue, and the assessor has the authority, it's a may, not a must, to disqualify if he discovers some of these conditions and was not notified. The assessor must disqualify the property at the owner's request, or if the property is sold to an exempt owner. If he discovers, either through notification or otherwise, that the land is not being used as forest land. If the common ownership interests are outside the limits, 5,000 acres or 10 acres. If the stocking and species requirements are not met, again, the Department of Forestry is charged with monitoring and notifying the assessor if those conditions are not met. And if there's a recording of the subdivision plot. If property is disqualified, it's subject to, I call it a penalty here because it's shorter than additional tax, but basically it's an additional tax, and that's specified in 31 of the bill, section 31. The additional tax is for each year, for a period of up to 10 years. You compute the difference between the property tax on the property if it were in the industrial program at 100%, and the property tax that was actually paid on the property as small tract forest land. So the difference between that each year and for the number of years that the program was in the property was in the small tract forest land program, up to a maximum of 10 years. Now this actually imposes the amounts of penalty here are deemed imposed in the year deferred. So if it was 6 years ago that the tax was deferred, then the unsegregated account percentages for the assessor in that year determine how that money goes back out. However, it is payable prior to the next property tax rule. And the question that I raise later and talk about a little bit is whether or not this penalty is sufficient to avoid properties from exiting to avoid the harvest tax. Severance tax, again, the Department of Revenue is charged with administering the severance tax. They are charged ahead of time now with going out. You've got a year where you've got an extension of the existing 80-20 program year before the April, a little over a year before April, when landowners will have to either elect to be taxed as small tract forest land or continue in the 100% program. the department is required to go out and advertise, essentially, what are the advantages and opportunities in the existence, essentially, of this program. They're also, once the program is in effect, required to monitor the Department of Forestry's notification of operations. Basically, that's filed anytime somebody walks into the forest with a chainsaw. So they know what, who's cutting, when, and where. They are then required to mail a form to any timber to the owners of timber which was harvested during the period, if they're in the small tract forest land program. So they need to know who's in the program, and they need to know who's harvesting. They find out who's harvesting from the Department of Forestry notice of operations. They find out who's in the program from those applications that are forwarded by the county assessor to the Department of Revenue. They're also required to report back to the legislature in 2009, and basically the question, I think, primarily is how's the program working in general, but specifically, are the harvest tax rates achieving the purposes of achieving revenue neutrality, essentially, of bringing in the same amount of money that would be raised if the property were on at 100%. Owners report now to the Department of Revenue, as I said, by January 31 for the activities of the previous calendar year, and they pay the tax at that time, although this bill does forgive any tax that's less than $10. Sets up two new funds. This may be a little bit confusing. We have the Western Oregon Timber Tax Account, and we have the Eastern Oregon Timber Tax Account. Those are eliminated, gone, by. We now have the Western Oregon Timber Tax Fund. Okay, so those are established. The Department of Revenue is allowed to pay its administrative expense out of these accounts, and the balance in those accounts is distributed 60.5% to the state school fund, 4.5% to the county community college support fund, and then 35% goes back to the counties after the end of the fiscal year. Based on their share of small tract forest land assessed value. So it's proportionately with the amount of value in this program. And it is county general fund revenue. Disqualifications, now we're getting into some of the sections which are not quite so substantive. We have already in law the definitions of when the additional tax occurs, the occurrence, the calculation, and when that additional tax or penalty can be deferred. Again, this adds small tract option, small tract forest land to those provisions and deletes the Western Oregon small tract option tax. Again, with respect to notification of special requirements in section 34 to 54. Severance tax administration, again, all of the functions that the department does in terms of audit and examinations of returns, issuing warrants, and so on, all of these have to have the new program added into their authority, and that's done in those sections. The conforming amendments then deal again with deleting basically the Western Oregon Small Tract Option Tax and adding Section 63 has to do, again, this is the has to do with the one-year exemption extension of the existing program. So you do have the Western Oregon Timber Tax Account in effect for another year. And currently in that account, forestry funds the reforestation tax credit and the small tract option tax out of the administration of those programs out of that account. Well, the Western Oregon small tract option tax is going away, and so that's deleted, but they've also added some of the costs that they occur under the Forest Practices Act and allow those to be funded. And those, I think, are primarily in connection with, again, the meeting minimum stocking and species requirements required by this bill.
Mr. Yates, just a clarification on that issue. We're extending the 80-20 program for a year, but we're also allowing the Western Oregon State Timber tax to be deleted. There's no apparent conflict in that. We're taking out WOST, Western Oregon State Tax,
yes,
deleting that from the provisions, yet we're extending the 80-20 rule for a year.
Really, the 2001 legislature eliminated the small tract option tax. But because...
And we're just taking it off the books with this legislation. Right. But when we extend the 80-20 rule, that's just extending the interim plan before this plan would go into effect.
I'm not sure that all properties that were in the small tract option tax are now in the 80-20 program, but I think they were. I think they are. Again, the options, the timing of some of those options to be able to move from the 80-20 to the 100%, it's not clear to me that there was time for anybody to opt into the 100% program. So I don't know, but I think all of those properties would be in the 80-20 program now. So that just continues their ability, forces them to remain in the 80-20 for another year.
Okay.
Because there's no option here to get into the 100%. There's also some change here which moves the distribution on the state school fund and the community college support fund up to May 1st. That's just a timing issue as to when the dollars are paid out. There's a provision in here now. We had in the 99 legislature required that the Department of Revenue determine by, I think, January of 2001, whether properties, forest land ownerships were above or below 5,000 acres. This asks them to essentially keep and track that regularly so they know every year who's qualified essentially to be in the small tract option tax because they have less than 5,000 acres and who's forced into the 100% program. And it also changes it so it's 5,000 acres. It was previously 5,000 acres west side, east side. It's now 5,000 acres statewide. And it repeals the transition provision. WOSDOT repeal, there's just a lot of sections. 16 sections are actually repealed. 13 sections, you're basically just deleting the WOSDOT language and adding back in the small tract forest land. Examples here, dwellings, conservation policy and plans, hardwood, riparian lands, those types of provisions. And then the miscellaneous section, is, which is 11 sections long, is only section reference changes. Technical issues then, which I'd identified essentially prior to the House meeting, was the question of the net subject to recovery. The bill was modified to include that. The severance tax rate index, that was previously on all value, and that's been narrowed to be the index is determined only on the small tract forest land values. And the last question then is gaming the system, whether or not there's an opportunity for people to move in and out of this program and do so in a way which reduces their tax burden. And I think the last thing I want to kind of do here, you should have another sheet which looks kind of like this. I can't make that much bigger among the printout materials. You have copies of the slides. Mm-hmm. And right behind the slide should be another sheet which we can look at.
Yeah.
What I'm trying to do here, this is useful both for explaining the penalty provision, but also asking whether or not you can game the system. And what I've done is to just allow a little model here so I can choose any particular, let me change this to FD to agree with what you have. Change this to site class FD. And I'd say in 100 acres. And once I choose the site class, it pulls up the rotation age for that site class, which for FD is 60 years. The yield, which is 36,100 board feet per acre at the time at rotation age. And its average, its assessed value under the 100% program and what would be its maximum assessed value under the small tract forest land program. So we have... in the first year here, 2004-2005, what the assessed value per acre would be, either 261 or at 20% of that, $52 under the small tract. I'm assuming in Western Oregon a tax rate of $10 per thousand. And if that's true, then the amount of tax deferred is $210. So out of a tax of $261, you defer 210 of it, and you pay 52 of it. There's some rounding there that I should show, I guess. But anyway. And then the next column is just accumulating this, so we went up the total property tax that was deferred. So if you come down here 5 years, you know, you're deferring around $210 to $250 a year, and that accumulates to about, you know, $1,356 in the first 6 years. I also computed the present value of that, which is just to say, okay, you've deferred that. Well, what is the value of that screen in the year when this deferral began, which is 2004? And again, I just assumed a 6% rate of interest in that present value calculation. The penalty. You'll notice that the penalty looks just like the total amount deferred up until 2013 in this case. And then in the next year, you add $282 in deferred tax, but you drop out the first $210. Because you only accumulate this for 10 years.
10-year rolling.
Right. So in the next year, while the total tax deferred goes to $2,685, the amount of the penalty only goes to $2,475. So the question is, and here we see the harvest tax rates, and I've assumed a 3% increase annually. So Western Oregon starts out at $389, and that increases at 3% per year. And I look at three different sort of management schemes, if you like, for forest management. First is a sustained yield. Now, we've got 100 acres on a 60-year rotation, and if it's a sustained yield forest, it cuts 1/60th every year, and for 100 acres, that's 1.67 acres a year. So at any given point in time, if you're down here, say, at 2011, the question is, is it worthwhile to opt out of this program in the prior year to avoid $288 in harvest tax? And the penalty is $1,606, so there's no problem. People are not going to be moving into and out of this program to avoid that harvest tax. The second one here is really a piece of property where the stand if the sustained yield is even, we can say this is a mature stand, i.e. there are more trees toward the end of the rotation cycle than there are at the early stages of the rotation cycle. So as you go on over time, you get more and more trees. So again, you can see the property tax is increasing here, but still $412. If this is, you know, you could propose some more aggressive distributions, I guess, but still $410 is nowhere near enough to get you to pay $1,606 in penalties to avoid that tax. When we shift to clear cutting, now here what I'm trying to envision is an acreage, a tax lot or whatever, that's either in or out of this program, and may be fairly even in terms of the trees all look alike. They'll all be cut basically at some point in time. They'll be clear cut. And so the question is, how many acres do you have to cut in order to break even with the penalty? So if you're going to cut more in this particular year, or we were here at 2012, if you're going to cut more than 10 acres, it would pay you to opt out of this program, pay the $1,864 in, well, you actually just exactly break even, pay the $1,864 in penalty and avoid $1,864 in harvest tax. And so that's why essentially the House put in the provision, okay, if you're going to do that, you've got to wait at least 5 years and pay these full property taxes for 5 years before you can get back into the program.
And by the way, Dick, we refer to these classifications of harvesting as regeneration harvests.
Okay.
Thank you.
That's the end of my sort of introduction.
Questions for Dick? Senator Hammond has a question.
Yes. Dick, I was looking through this. Does the Department of Forestry make the recommendation to the county assessor or the state revenue department? I mean, who makes the application goes to the Department of Forestry, and then they, in turn, say, yes, this is a valid small tract woodland operation or what?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hammond, no. The application goes to the county assessor.
Oh, county assessor.
And the county assessor has to determine whether or not...
Is there any method of going out and verifying, and who does the tracking to make sure that it's for the intended purpose?
I think the assessor, and we maybe should get some professional input on that, but I think the assessor's responsibility to make sure it remains in forest use, probably, though certainly the Department of Forestry, if they discovered it was not, is required by this bill to inform the assessor that it's not in forest use. The 5,000 acre, 10 acre, that would be the Department of Revenue's responsibility. They get the information essentially from the county assessor as to what properties are, what forest land is in the program, who the owners are, and they're getting information from all the counties in terms of who the owners of forest land are, and so they're matching up their data file essentially to aggregate all properties by owner. And if they find somebody over 5,000 acres, then they're required to notify the county assessor that that person is not meeting the requirements.
Okay. Because I was just wondering, if I bought an acreage and I exceeded the aggregate, who would know if I was exceeding the aggregate or not?
Well, two things. One, the bill requires you to inform the assessor if you know that you've exceeded the aggregate.
We're taking hostages, Senator.
If you don't, then just not informing the assessor gives him the authority to disqualify the property. And if through the process the department determines it, again, you would be disqualified once that occurred.
By extending this only 1 year, is this an attempt to create a program that carries forward until the new one is totally in place to take over?
Yes.
So when we adopted this in the last session, this was not
the small
anticipated.
The small woodlot owners and the group that was working on the plan have not been able to achieve agreement among themselves as to a plan that they have now.
Okay.
Mr. Yates is right. What happens is, if I recall, from the last legislative session, there was a inability of small woodland owners to meet a deadline set by the revenue chair in the previous session. And when we came into the last legislative session, it was agreed to give them another year to figure out what they needed to do. And they have, in fact, brought this plan. So that drives the necessity to extend for one more year the 80-20 program.
Okay.
Further questions? Well done, Mr. Yates. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We have several folks that wish to testify on this issue. Perhaps we should bring up Mr. Miller from the Department of Revenue.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Norm Miller. I'm with the Oregon Department of Revenue.
Okay.
And since Dr. Yates pretty much outlined the process the way it is, I'm going to shorten my testimony considerably because my role, I felt, was to kind of outline the details and to ask any technical questions that might be there, and I think Dr. Yates has actually done that. So from the Department of Revenue's perspective, House Bill 2197 represents the culmination of 5 years of work toward the creation of a method of matching the payment of property taxes with the flow of cash available to owners of smaller tracts of land. This methodology in many ways mirrors the current system for taxing small woodland owners. The changes, for the most part, were designed to decrease the administrative costs of the program, to keep the program current with forest land valuation changes that have taken place, and to bring the tax to be collected at harvest more in line with Measure 50, which is actually what started this whole process back in 1997. So with that, I think I want to do the one question about extension of the current program for the less than 5,000 acres owners. There are some reasons for that, so I'm skipping down to my point number three. It allows for the education of taxpayers before an April 1 of 2004 deadline for selection of an option. So it allows the county's time to prepare for switching the property tax classification of 41,000 taxpayers and to process those taxpayer options. It allows for development of return processing systems and to process these taxpayer options with the Department of Revenue. So the current privilege tax then will continue at 3.2% Western Oregon, 1.8% in Eastern Oregon for those less than 5,000 acre owners for harvests occurring between January 1 of 2003 and December 31st of 2003. So then just briefly, I'll kind of leaf through the rest of it. It also says the Department of Revenue will create an education plan and educate these landowners on what their options are. We've done that. Or we're in the process of creating that plan. If you go to page three, more or less lays out the numbers of taxpayers that we're talking about in some categories. And then what I did is created some examples that show, beginning on page four, of different sizes of land ownerships and how this impacts them. And I will note that in my first example, it shows for an owner in Clackamas County of less than 8 acres, that person does not qualify for the small owner option, but I thought it'd be important for you to be able to see why it is that they were excluded. In essence, what they end up paying, on their property about $24.64 in tax at 100%. If they paid it 20%, it'd be $4.88. So the difference between those two, the total tax would be $19.76. So the committee felt that because it was a smaller amount of money, that it was it probably would not harm them considerably if they were left out. I've set up the same examples then for Douglas County and some examples for Eastern Oregon. I won't go through those. And then provided some other information on page 7 that shows how the tax rates are indexed from one year to the next. If you have any questions about that, I'd be happy to answer, but I won't go through it. And then and lastly shows an example of how the property tax would work over, a 3-year period for a landowner. I guess with that, are there any questions?
You bet there are.
Okay.
I'll ask the committee first for their questions.
No.
First of all, I think we need to go back to the measure for a second. This was filed at the request of the governor through the State Department of Forestry. House Bill 2197. And you alluded to a 5-year period that it's taken to get here. And that had to do with a significant change in the way we assess and evaluate and tax on timberland. So, we sort of fast forward to this place where we are today. And essentially, this is the last brick in the wall of a carefully negotiated change in how taxes are assessed on private forest land. Is that not pretty close to your recollection of how we got here?
Vice Chair Ferrioli, that is my recollection also.
Okay, good. That even though this is sort of the last brick in the wall of a significant change in the way we do tax assessment, and that these costs and changes to the revenue flows are anticipated, they are also in the governor's budget, are they not?
Vice Chair Ferrioli, that is correct, yes.
Okay. So I just want to make sure everybody realizes that there are fiscal impacts on this bill, that they are anticipated impacts. This is a planned restructuring of the forest receipts and revenues, that there are no surprises in this bill. As a matter of fact, it's just taken us a long time to get here. But there is an issue that I do want to put on the record. I don't have any intention to derail the consideration of this bill since it's been such a long time getting here. But we have a differential between the assessment process for eastern and western forest lands. On western forest lands, we've got 8 categories of assessment. On eastern forest lands, there's 1. So is it the Department of Revenue's position that there's only one kind of forest class or forest site class in eastern Oregon?
Sure. Or Mr. Vice Chair, Department of Revenue is basically administers the programs that the legislature hands them to them. In 1961, as I recall, the legislature then determined that they would tax forest land in Oregon, as I recall it, at a $25 per acre rate, and they would set one rate for all of eastern Oregon. You know, I really don't have the history of why that was determined to be just one rate.
Okay.
At that time, and we've carried that history forward, yes.
All right, and but there are 8 rates for Western Oregon.
That is correct.
What are they based on?
Mr. Vice Chair, the rates at this point in time are based on the productivity of the land in Eastern Oregon, basically referred to as site class in a lot of respects. So it's the ability of that land to grow timber.
Okay. So the assumption is that we have one site class in Eastern and 8 site classes in Western isn't really an assumption about the site classes so much as it is just about the different methodology.
That is correct. It was recognized that there were differences between Eastern Oregon and Western Oregon all along. There are some major differences in how trees grow, in the amount of rainfall that's received, and how logs are measured. The forest industry deals differently in Eastern Oregon than they do in Western Oregon for a lot of respects. So that division was made, or has been made over time, yes.
Thank you. That essentially puts on the record the information that I wanted to put into the record. It's essentially that there is some information and some studies that help differentiate site classes in Western Oregon. We don't have that information for Eastern Oregon, so we are making an assumption. At some point in the future, there may be a revisitation of that issue, but not in this bill.
Mr. Vice Chair, that's correct.
Further questions for this witness, Mr. Miller? We have a couple of other folks that are here to testify. Wally Rutledge, and could you come forward? Fire at will, sir.
Mr. Vice Chair and members of the committee, my name is Wallace Rutledge, and I'm the Director of Forestry Assistance for the Department of Forestry. Before I start my full testimony, I might just address the question or the issue you put on the table just a little bit ago, Vice Chair. I think that you have a copy of the report that our committee put together.
Yes.
In this report, we had 3 recommendations. One of those recommendations is that we bring forward a streamlined version of the 2080 program, and that is in House Bill 2197. Our second recommendation is that there needs to be further study and work on a conservation incentive program, and we handed that issue off to another committee that was established by the last legislature. It was kind of known as House Bill 3564 Working Group. That working group took that issue, and they're developing a report that's going to be brought to the legislature just a little bit later, and I believe they also are crafting a bill that would incorporate that recommendation. The third recommendation then deals with the issue that you brought forward, and that recommendation is that there does indeed need to be further study done to deal with the not only the tax issue in Eastern Oregon, but also the fire fee that's assessed to forest lands in Eastern Oregon. So that our committee recognized that that's an issue, and there does need to be further study.
And Mr. Rutledge, that really is the only reason I brought the issue to the table today, is that there are some unanswered questions about site classes in Eastern Oregon.
Vice Chair, that's correct. And the committee recognized that and said we need to do further study.
Okay.
I'll keep my testimony very brief since you've already gone through the bill and so forth. You've got a little background history of the working group and how it was established, and I'd just like to highlight a few of the elements from that report that I referred to that the committee produced. And one of those is some factors that affect family and non-industrial forest lands differently than the large forest landowners. That's on the bottom of the front page of my testimony. And number one is there's a higher operating cost generally associated with smaller forest land parcels because of the economy of scales. They are dealing with smaller acres, and in general, in most cases, they have a difficult time getting things done as inexpensively as the larger landowner that can do it many more acres at one time. Another issue is that a lot of small forest land tracts are proportionally more impacted by regulations such as riparian buffers or sensitive wildlife sites than a large acreage ownership might be. A third one is that there may be forced premature harvesting of timber to deal with estate taxes. Large landowners, particularly industrial landowners, don't have to deal with estate taxes, but small tract forest landowners do have to deal with those from time to time. Also, an issue that's becoming more and more of a problem for the small tract forest landowners is a difficulty in marketing their products. With the closure of a lot of the mills, and particularly in eastern Oregon, this is becoming a real issue. The small woodland owner with a small volume, or in today's market with large logs or other traditional or non-traditional specialty wood commodities, may have a difficult time finding a market for those products. Another issue that's already been alluded to is that money may not be available to pay taxes, since these forest landowners of these larger tracts and small tracts only harvest infrequently, or sometimes may not even harvest during their whole lifetime. So those are a few of the differences that the committee dealt with in trying to put together a program for the small tract forest landowners. A couple of other issues I'd like to highlight a little bit that I've already touched on just briefly, and that's the forest land values. The group explored a long-standing notion of using farm values for forest land assessment. After some considerable amount of discussion, it was found that the counties use different values in different counties for different types of forest land or farmland, and there's a lot of different classifications of that. The issue really in the values would be too complex and lacked a whole lot of consistency to try and use those values for forest land across the state. And so they kind of disregarded that. The other one is the considerable amount of discussion and concern dealing with the eastern forest land values that we've already touched on a little bit. Another issue and challenge that the group was charged with is to look at reducing administrative costs of the present tax programs. And there's a couple ways that the group dealt with this. One is to eliminate the landowners under 10 acres. And that's been touched on a little bit. But in reality, a landowner that has under 10 acres, the tax bill is very small. That landowner really does not depend upon that forest land for an income. They have other income, and so they can afford to pay a small amount of taxes on an annual basis. Those particular owners really own about 1% of the total forest land value in the state. And because of the infrequency in filing taxes and so forth, that's a group of landowners that make a large amount of mistakes and cause a large amount of administrative costs. The other issue in reducing the cost is to change from a value-based tax to a volume-based tax. That simplifies it not only for the Department of Revenue to administer, but it simplifies it for the landowner, thereby decreasing administrative costs and greatly simplifying it for the landowner. The other issue that we dealt with that I wanted to highlight was the conservation option, and I've already touched on that a little bit. You've heard what the bill does. I'd just like to maybe in summary, saying that this bill creates a simple and easy to understand for the landowner, administratively efficient and cost-effective small tract optional program that replaces two existing tax programs right now. And it should, we hope, and it's designed to encourage small tract forest landowners to willingly make long-term investments in their forest land that consider the long-term nature and the growth of timber, and Oregon's public policy that encourages the growing and harvesting of forest resources. I thank you for your time and consideration, and I encourage you to pass House Bill 2197A out of committee with a due pass recommendation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions at this time that you might have.
Questions from the committee? Thank you for your testimony.
Okay, thank you.
Christina McNitt, Neil Westfall, please come forward. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt, and I'm representing the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. And with me is Mr. Neil Westfall. He was a member of the interim committee that worked on this issue. He's also representing the Oregon Small Woodlands Association, and he's a member of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. And I would like to state for the record that Mr. Westfall hails from Myrtle Point, which is about 3 hours away, and he's not unique in the type of time investment that was provided by a variety of landowners on this committee. I'm not going to get into the details or read my testimony into the record. It's been covered very well already, but I would like to point out that the interim committee had 12 people on it. Three of them had expertise from Eastern Oregon. There were members from Southern Oregon, from Western Oregon. We had two county assessors. We had the expertise of the Departments of Forestry and Revenue. Mr. Norm Miller and Mr. Wally Rutledge were outstanding in providing a lot of resources to an incredibly technical and difficult issue that, frankly, was a big step for the Small Woodlands Association to be able to put together a consensus. And Dr. Yates also provided some guidance when we were setting our harvest or severance tax rates. I think that the record's been covered clearly. This consensus committee actually came up with three recommendations. One of those recommendations is to come up with an alternative 2080 deferral plan, which is in House Bill 2197A. The two outstanding issues are the Eastern Oregon land values, basically the cost of maintaining land in Eastern Oregon. That includes the property tax assessed values and the fire protection costs. And then finally, we had a conservation incentives piece that, recognizing the state of finances facing Oregon right now, we decided not to try to combine everything into House Bill 2197, but to build in pieces. And this is our product this afternoon.
Thank you. Mr. Westphal.
Really not a lot to add, Mr. Vice Chair and committee members. It was an educational opportunity and experience to serve on the committee for me.
May I ask you to grant your name for the record?
I'm Neil Westfall.
Thank you.
And serving on the committee was a very interesting task, and I believe what we came up with has been very well covered today by everybody else, and I support and urge you to support House Bill 2197A.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Westfall or Ms. McNitt? Hearing and seeing none, thank you for your testimony. That concludes our hearing on Senate Bill 2197. If there is no one else here present that wishes to testify. Hearing and seeing none, I would like to thank Mr. Yates for a lucid and understandable presentation on what is a complicated issue, and express a great deal of appreciation to the members of the task force, including the folks from the Department of Forestry that brought forth this issue, and the Department of Revenue that assisted in the creation of this very complicated but necessary piece of legislation. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2197, and with that, we are in recess. No, adjourned. We're adjourned.